Everyone has some sort of a closet that has become too small. A closet is no place to live, and I want to support as many people as I can in stepping out of that prison into the fullness of life that is waiting for them on the other side of that door. This is Nancy Shadlock from Centered Life Coaching. Join me in listening to these coming out chronicles. Get curious about their stories. And then go see what good things are waiting for you on the other side of your closet door.
Jennifer Knapp, I can't believe you are sitting here with me today. This is incredible.
Well, that sounds like you're like fanning there for a second.
I am. My high school self is just like, what? Is this really happening?
Now, just goes to show that if you want to talk to anybody you think is like important in the world, all you have to do is start a podcast, send out an email to somebody who's like, you know, shamelessly willing to self-promote themselves. And that's all you get. But no, it's lovely to be here.
I wish I could go back in time and tell my high school and college self that this would happen, because she wouldn't believe me. We used to sit around in Bible college with all of us who now have come out. And we said, oh, I wish Jennifer Knapp could come and do like a house concert here for us and just hang out, and we'd visit. And it was before you or any of us came out, so it was pretty fortuitous.
Well, see, now that you mentioned Bible college, now I want to turn the tables and do an interview with you and ask you about all of that. Because I mean, I really appreciate that. In fact, like for me, when I got a lot of my start, you know, in the contemporary Christian music industry, and I was young and in my 20s and hanging out, basically, you know, all my peers were college age peers. I really appreciated, you know, people who are going to faith-based colleges, obviously. But now that I've gone through like divinity school in my older years, I just think there's, it's interesting to me, like when I was at Vanderbilt Divinity School, more than 50% of our cohort were women. The numbers were like really high. And then on top of that, like a huge queer contingency from in one direction or another. And I think particularly with women, because when we're talking about like a Christianity in particular, you're basically talking about like, especially like with in the United States, you're talking about straight white males, right? Mm-hmm. And so now for the last 20 some odd years, people who are really trying to problematize scripture or figure out what the hell is going on ended up in schools of study. And I think it's really amazing to me that the people that are really willing to dive deep into that are largely like, yeah, women, like biologically born women and queer folk who are just diving right into it, you know, taking their faith seriously with some degree, but with a willingness to be critical about who we've been receiving it from for all these years. So I think it's really fantastic because, yeah, I think you go to an average div school today and you'll find that there are fewer straight white males there, people of color, lots of queer people, and tons of female, you know, biologically born females. You know, it's just crazy. So I really appreciated that.
The amount of queer female pastors I know, it's crazy.
Yeah. And I think that's a interesting and amazing sign about like not the death of our spiritual process, you know, for whatever. I think, you know, if we draw a line somewhere and there a distinction between what's religion and what's spirituality, mm-hmm. I think a lot of us would say we have a deep understanding something of our spiritual nature, right? We're human beings, and somewhere in there we're trying to make sense of the world and trying to make sense of something that seems greater than what we are. But religion isn't always necessarily the script that holds that. And yet it also is that it's kind of interesting because when we have faith traditions like Christianity or Islam or Judaism, there's somewhat of a tradition or a legacy of people who have a language and an understanding of this. But the distinction, I think, when I make, you know, I think you run into people today who would identify with the statement, well, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. I'm interested in my spiritual nature, but I'm not necessarily interested in joining a cult. and the prescriptions and the rules. And it's not necessarily even about a rebellion against the rules, but this idea that, you know, one size fits all. I think in particular for a queer community, we understand that that's not really quite the way that it is, but to fully separate ourselves out from mentors or people who know what that experience is like is kind of one of those interesting obstacles. I think that people who've been through a faith-based education have started to appreciate in the last couple of decades. So I'm really actually energized by how many people are kind of rewriting the script and helping find a way that I think is unique to the LGBTQ+ mm-hmm. Folks in our experience to look at religion in a different way. We're essentially queering religion in the sense it is like, it's not just this heteronormative, you know, we didn't realize for a very long time, I think, how much heteronormativity mm-hmm. shaped our religious experience. And now to realize that it doesn't necessarily have to be shaped by one perspective really adds a lot of vibrancy, I think, to a tradition that may be able to give us hope for the future, be able to see how diverse it can be. So that's the end of my soapbox for now.
Well, I'll add on that a little bit. When I did my master's, I became a spiritual director through it, and, you know, learned how to sit with people and help them pay attention to their spiritual side. And then when I came out, I kind of like put that to the side and was like, oh, no one in the church is going to respect me, because if I'm not obeying the Bible, then I'm going to be, you know, disqualified as someone who can help people pay attention to their spiritual side. And so then I like did more of this coming out coaching, and now I've kind of come full circle where I'm bringing it back into my work and being like, yeah, actually a lot of people want support in connecting to the divinity that is within them and all around them. And in some ways, yeah, I think by being honest about my queerness, it helps me connect or helps other people connect as well. And so it's been really fun to bring that up again.
I love that full circle. That full circle thing too, because that's an experience I've had, I think, initially. Like, I wouldn't necessarily, I'm a card carrying Christian these days. That's just weird theological kind of things we can get into at some point. But I mean, Christianity
is heaven or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really the way that I look at it. And I think for a lot of reasons, I think for a lot of people that translation for what they think a Christian is and does, it gets complicated for me to try and explain why Christianity is the language or the base knowledge of my faith and where I come from a lot of the time theologically. That's a diversion. But going back to what you were saying about the full circle, I think when I came out, and I think particularly in evangelical environments that are conservative, that have preached and I've taught for a very long time that being gay or in queer in any sense disqualifies you from being engaged inside of the faith community, or even, you know, even in a spiritual sense, loved by God, that's a disqualification. I think that divorce that happened for me, you know, I like, in order to survive that for me in my own coming out, I was just like assumed, okay, well, now I don't get to have that anymore. I don't get to have that spiritual thing. And so frankly, I kind of didn't want to hang out with people who didn't love me. Right. Mm-hmm. So it was really a necessary step to kind of painfully divorce myself from that faith-based experience. And yet, after, you know, and I, Bishop Gene Robinson, I think he's retired now, but he was one of the first Episcopal priests in the United States that was ordained. So he was ordained a bishop in the Episcopal Church here in the United States. He was out, and it was this big hullabaloo about 20 years ago, but one of the things he said when talking to LGBTQ+ people inside of faith was saying, you don't have to go back to church. Like, it was, you know, it may not be a healthy place for you. It may be too traumatizing. And at the same time, he would say, if you can be there and you want to be there, then go. Like, we need you there. We need the visibility of who we are. But it's not the expectation. There's no, I think when I heard him say that, it really opened up a permission for me to say, listen, I'm not ready to go back. I may not want to go back, and I don't have to go back. Mm-hmm. But the permission that there was an opportunity for me to potentially go back and that it would be okay was something that I didn't entertain until I heard him say that. And when I came full circle, it was strange. Like, the dust had settled down. I had calm down in my own coming out experience and calmed down and got comfortable with the divorce, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Then I was able to kind of step off and then look at going, wait a second. Now, like for me, like the narrative that I would tell you is like, wait a second. Like I realized that I cut this whole thing out, I think as a survival tactic. So I'll give myself, you know, some good grace on that side. But it's like the fighter in me is like, you don't get to take this away from me. You know, you don't get to take the perspective and the good parts of this that are meaningful and have made my life better and rich and beautiful. And so what does that mean? And so slowly but surely, I was really quite surprised, because in one way I was really excited at the front, like, oh, coming out. And now that I'm gay, I can like jettison all the things about the religious and church experience and yay, piss off everybody. And then later on going, I'm missing some of those things. And to have them come back was an interesting thing to have to, I think it was the harder part of the reconciliation. It was actually easier to say goodbye to something than it was to say, I'm going to accept this journey in some way. So it was, I don't know. It was all to say that I really appreciate like what you're saying. Like we have to kind of go some, I think a lot of LGBTQ people that I talk to experience that cycle where we go through the divorce and we imagine because of trauma or because we just simply can't at the time, figuring out how we're going to live without our faith-based experience, and then realize that somewhere in there, there is a language and a people and a spiritual context of our own lives that we want to make sense of. And so walking back and going through the things that we have in the experiences of the good parts of that, allowing us to at least redeem some of the things that had led us to that space, and good healing. Like it's good healing for us. It's good wholeness in our own lives to be able to account for our spiritual selves. So, and you know, falling into a community of people, not just inside of the LGBTQ plus community, but for people who are knowledgeable about things of spirit, things of, you know, a language and a practice and guidance and mentorship. I think that's what really excites me inside of faith traditions, because I think we've missed out. This is a little push back against patriarchy, like the way that patriarchy is often talked about leadership, right? As this kind of top-down authority where I authorize you and tell you what you should do and what you should say. And I think one of the things that I'm really loving about seeing a lot of queer folks come into religious spaces is we're kind of changing what leadership look like. It looks more like mentorship, more like partnership, walking with and beside someone as we learn and navigate these things together. And having a community that isn't about being watchdogs and accountability in that sense, but being with you and beside you and alongside. And so when troubles do come, or when we're trying to learn something new, or we're challenged by some aspect of our lives, we have other people who've had that experience before that go, well, you can try that, but you know, here's an option for you. And let's pool that wisdom rather than us telling you what to do, but be with you as you do it and help guide you along that path, that if I've had experience in that path before, I can be that with you.
Yeah. And, you know, encouraging people that they have the wisdom within them. They don't need it from somewhere out there, and the divine is in them, so they can listen to that and not need that outside
that voice. Bing, that's on one of my lists. Like that, it's another ding against, I think, patriarchy, in that I think as a female body in that space, one of the things that I think women have learned inside of that religious context of conservatism is to actually deny the voice of listening to your own inner strength. Mm-hmm. And it has been a mantra inside of Christianity in particular to kind of distrust and disown ourselves, right? That it's bad, that we're born bad, and that nothing that we do or say has any value, that we should only either listen to God's voice and as a woman, listen to a man, but don't listen to yours, you know, and that kind of guidance. And when I think about the deeper spiritual challenges that I've had in the context of Christianity, one of the hardest things that I ever had was to trust my own voice, because so many people for so long, it had ingrained in me how evil my own voice was. Yeah. And all that time that I spent away from the church was in getting, I didn't realize it at the time, but I spent 7 years trying to find my own voice. Mm-hmm. You know, what is, with all the voices that go on in our heads, voices of our parents, voices of our community, voices of, you know, you don't have to be from a religious environment to have more than your own voice kind of block, you know, making a cacophony of sound in between your ears. But that time that I took away from that space and from public life, I just realized like I have no idea what voice I can listen to. When do I need to key into my own voice? And after I found my own voice and had comfort in discovering what that was and confidence in my own trustworthiness to say, you know, oh, you're lying to yourself and you know it. Okay. You know what? You're right. You know, like those kinds of things, or, you know what, you're doing the best that you can right now. And you really, you know, and genuinely believe that you're not, and genuinely be able to check in and know that you're actually being able to tell your own self is telling you the truth about who you are. And I think in particular for a queer community, we relate to that, right? Like, I'm pretty much gay. Like, people can problematize that for you all you want, but that's all you know is your inner voice. It's like, I don't know how to explain it to you. This is just what it is. And to be able to trust in that and be able to rely on that is something that I think we take for granted. It seems like something that we're just supposed to automatically have, but we have so much inundating us with, you know, from external sources, whether it's family, whether it's a faith community, whether it's politically, we're social media people now, where all of these, you know, I have an empathy for people who are overwhelmed by like the peer pressures of social media, because it, in a sense, I think it's like we've all become famous to a degree. Like the early on in my career, when there wasn't any of the social media, like there's so much press, right? That like as an artist who's lived a public life for a very long time, you know, it's what I call an avatar. Like there's a version of me that lives and exists out in the world that people are talking about 1,000, 100 miles away. They have a picture of me in their minds about who I am, what I think, and what I do. Like you were talking about, you were going, I wish I could meet Jennifer Knapp and that she would come and hang out and do a house show at our Bible college. Like you've never met me, you know, and yet some part of that, because of you met, you know, you heard the music of this entity, you wanted to know that person and you get a picture in your mind of who that person is, even though you may never meet them in your whole lives. And I think that that's all to say is that now that we all have these social media accounts, that we're building this public persona outside of ourselves, that's exactly what it is. We now have press releases for our own lives that are accessible for every single one of us. It's not just the domain of people who are in the public life. We are all in a public world now. And I think that adds pressure. And I think for me, sometimes that realization, when I talk to some of my friends who don't realize the pressures of them, I'm going, no, like you're a rock star now. It's the same thing that I've been dealing with 30 years. It's just now that you have the opportunity to be talked about away from your home and away from your intimates in a way that you don't get to control as much as you did when you were, you know, perhaps years ago.
So and there's to no be able retrieve to, either. Like you never get away from it.
Yeah. And so I think it takes a little bit of mindfulness actually to be able to say, hey, there. And that's why I like, here's a fun little tidbit for what I do. Like I have a not unlike Beyonce, who has her alter ego of Sasha Fierce. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that, but I have an alter ego that I use in my pride, like particularly in and amongst my friends, that like my alter ego is Big Dolores. So Big Dolores is the third person. It's a way of me referring to like this public life that I have, going, oh, that's Big Dolores. Like I'm going to have to put on makeup today and take a shower and go do a bunch of things that exhaust me, because all I want to do is sit at home in my PJs, but I'm going to go to work and I'm going to go to work and I'm going to put on my Big Dolores clothes and I'm going to go out and do that kind of stuff. And it's really helpful to kind of understand, like that was really helpful for me in terms of my own mental health, the kind not, it sounds a little dodgy, like, right? That it's like, maybe she's got a split personality. That's not good mental health. But to be able to kind of understand like what's happening out there, we all go to work, we have different masks, you know, we have different roles that we play in different spaces. To be able to take a second and understand what role you're playing and prepare yourself for that role, and to be understanding like, yeah, this is what I want to do today. I'm going to go out and I'm going to be a rock star today. I'm going to put my guitars on. I'm going to share more of my life than I would probably do with a complete stranger. As long as I understand that that's what I'm doing in that day, Big Dolores is really helpful. And it's also really helpful at home when I go to talk to my wife. I'm going, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be here this weekend because Big Dolores has work for me to do. And you can be mad at her and not me.
Right. And she doesn't have to deal with Big Dolores, you know, in the intimate moments where she just wants to be chill and have deep conversations with you. Yeah.
But to understand that that's, you know, just understand that other people are looking at a portion of yourself that you really can't control. You know, mm-hmm. people do build up a picture in your mind, of what something is apart from you. And we all do it to a degree. I don't think it's anything that can be necessarily avoided, but it is something we can understand that happens in the world, and to protect ourselves a little bit, going, you know what? Yeah, that's being said about this entity, but that entity is not necessarily me. It's somewhat of a firewall between us and the intimates of the world, because at the end of the day, it's impossible for us to, you know, to be in contact with literally the entire globe, mm-hmm. to nurture all of those relationships with safety and with understanding and with care. It's impossible for that many people to be thinking about you and your care. So it becomes that much more important to be able to understand who our intimates are, who the places of safety are, in the same way that we need to preserve that for ourselves individually in our own self-care, but then our intimate, you know, that next level outward from us, in building those relationships, to have an understanding of that in our private lives. And it, at least for me, has been really helpful and actually empowering to not just, you know, make my world safer and my day-to-day life safer at home, right, as me and as my everyday person, but also to not be afraid of the outside world in that mm-hmm. sense. Now that I know who I am and I kind of took care of that, I take one step further to the outside. And mm-hmm. then I'm able to say, you know, even in put it in context, so between my first career and my second career, like I said, I had a 7-year break in between where I wasn't worried about public life at all. And in that time, getting comfortable within my own self and my own skin, once I knew who I was in that space and I could recognize my own voice, the tackle to getting back to music was like, oh, how will I handle a public life? Because when I have this public life, people are going to see that I'm gay because I'm married, you know, I have these relationships and they're stable now. But what happens when I invite all of these strangers, you know, into my world? That's just too many people to invite over to your house for one sitting.
Yeah.
Like, I can't cater to everyone, but I can feed a few people. So what does that mean? And so when you have a good sense and a good foundation, and at least for me, when I had that good sense of who I was, then I was able to problematize that a little bit and invite more people in. What happens when I open the door and I show people this? And yeah, like, all the bad things that were going to happen did, like, all the haters were going to hate. And but the thing that I didn't anticipate is all the people that we're going to love, like, all the support that I was going to find and all the new friends that I was going to make inside of that. And that the only way I had the courage to be able to do that is to know something solidly of my own experience first. That way, when all of those other voices started to come in, I could still make sense and find my own when I needed to.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly why I do this podcast, is so that people who are kind of at the beginning part of their coming out journey, they can hear these stories of, like, okay, I came out, I found my authentic voice, and it was worth it, and there was good in the end. And so I love what you were saying earlier too about hearing your authentic voice, because my partner and I were just recently on a road trip, and we were listening to your audiobook Facing the Music, and you were just talking yesterday about, you know, you'd just become a Christian at college, and then you're feeling really confused about, like, how do I hear my voice? And you were kind of starting to get that indoctrination of, like, any of your fleshly desires are evil, put those away. And I, like, paused it and was like, this is what's so important. And my partner hadn't grown up in, like, that Christian jargon shit, and so she was like, oh, wow, that's so crazy that you were just indoctrinated that like, any of your earthly physical desires were wrong. And then it was like, how do you hear yourself? And so I love that, you know, I heard that yesterday, and today I was feeling a bit bad that I hadn't finished the whole book before I talked to you. And then I was like, actually, this is perfect, because I haven't yet heard your coming out part in the book. And so why don't you take it away and tell me how that came to be, that you, like, came out.
Yeah, I think it in stages, really. I mean, you know, I think it's really amazing, because I think there's one big obvious space that we could look to, like, in April, I think April of 2010 was when the press release So it was like, the, you know, not everybody gets a press release, right? And it doesn't really actually happen that way in everyday life, because as well, I was very much gay before that press release came out and was living a very gay life, I guess, if you could call a life
lifestyle.
Gay life. But
wasn't it?
Yeah, right. Whatever. Like, we're all laughing right now at that comment. But, you know, I mean, it's so weird to me, because I mean, I was a late bloomer in that sense. I didn't basically kind of acknowledge my own sexual orientation, or kind of it wasn't even a lack of acknowledgement. I just didn't kind of clue in. Like, it was almost like the pieces of the puzzle finally fell into place to where, oh my God, this totally makes sense. So I was a late bloomer in that regard. I was in my late 20s. I'd spent 10 years like not playing the field at all. So I went from college. When I became a Christian, I'd had sex, I'd had relationships. They were largely heterosexual in nature. It didn't really occur to me that there was another option, because that all those kind of sucked. And then I became a Christian, where inside of the time that I was there in evangelical Christianity and the role of my work was that it was problematic for me to have any relationship whatsoever. As you and I were discussing earlier, I'm not necessarily on the super femme side. So people have always kind of questioned and wondered what my sexual orientation was, because I'm just not super girly. I'm not a super butch either, but I'm somewhere in between. And so people had always kind of questioned whether or not that I was gay or not. And I was just like, I don't know. I grew up in Kansas. There were gay people around, but also growing up in the late 70s, early 80s, the press wasn't real good to kind of open the door to that. Right. So it just never really occurred to me. And it wasn't a driving desire either. So like I said, after 10 years of celibacy inside of Christian music industry, I didn't have good relationships with women. Like, I just kind of shut myself off from any men, because any guy that I was close to or had any kind of just even remotely looked like we were too close of friends, people go, oh, you're having sex with him. And I'm like, and that could ruin my career. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with women, like any other women that are really close to, oh, you're having sex with them, because like, I'm not having sex with anybody. So I just kind of shut that down, but that didn't really work very well pushing into my 30s. And then I met my now wife of 20 years. The story she tells is that I kept punching her on the arm.
So where did you meet her?
We met working she's in the production side of things. So, she was bossing me around at a bunch of festivals, and that was kind of a turn on, if we'll be frank. But I didn't kind of realize that I was even flirting with her, you know, for a really long time, until finally one day she was like, okay, my arm is way too sore. You've got to stop punching me in the arm. I think you like me. And I think I do too. And, you know, basically my coming out was like falling in love, you know, it's totally like a lesbian U-Haul kind of situation, where it's just like, all of a sudden the world just made sense when I just said, I really actually care about this person. And that person, you know, same, you know, I was, oh, like, wow, like the plumbing on this person is the same as mine. And now this is an issue for everybody else. But I, you know, I fell in love with her, and that was just something that it just made sense to me. And I think one of the first conversations I ever had was actually between my mother and I, and we're not super close, but I, you know, I'd been building a relationship with my partner, and I would get on the phone. It was like it was difficult for me to talk to anybody about this person I was spending so much time with, because I didn't really know how to talk about it. And I would go, oh, like we were getting ready to take a vacation and explore our relationship and see if this, you know, we were starting to essentially date, I guess. And I kept using the we language. I don't know if anybody else does this, but you know, we were going to do this and we were going to do that. But I kept my partner's name out, like gender out of it. I just was so neutral, never like said he or she or anything like that. It was always we. And my mom finally one day was like, is the we a she? And I was like, yeah. Yeah, the we is a she. And my mom was like, finally, like that makes so much more sense. It's like, why did you tell me this in junior high? It would have gone so much better if you just opened the door and told me that was an option, you know? Yeah. But yeah, so it was gradual. Like, you know, my mom was just like, you're into a chick, aren't you? And I'm like, yeah, I totally am. And it turned out that chick I've been into for a very long time. And another kind of landmark moment that I tell is like, I think we had been together then. I'd moved to Australia. We'd lived together for 5 years. You know, it was clear that we'd made a commitment to one another. And I think after about that time, I don't know, I didn't think too much about it because I wasn't away. I wasn't living in a world where like people were talking LGBTQ or being queer or wasn't an issue. My family loved me. My family loved my partner. We were just living our lives the same way that most people do. Like we just lived our lives. And about 5 years into it, my brother-in-law goes, oh yeah, you know, nothing like a lesbian to something, like called me a lesbian. I was like, what? Like, it just like, it never occurred to me, like, even like, cause I don't know, I was just in love with the person that I was in love with. And so that made me realize like, oh yeah, I guess I am like really like different, I guess in some particular way. And I think building that relationship, then knowing that that was a relationship, obviously, that I'd been in for like 7 or 8 years by the time I decided to come back and do music. It was definitely a political thing here in the U.S. I mean, about that time, Proposition 8, which was this huge voting thing that was going on in California about gay marriage that was happening prior to DOMA falling in the United States. It was just a big, you know, political contest over, you know, who should and who shouldn't be allowed to be married in the U.S. And that got the Christians even more up in arms and vocal about it and pouring all their money into those conversations. And I knew that, you know, once people were finding out that I was making music again and that the rumor part of it just didn't sit well with me. I mean, I wanted to be very clear because from a responsibility standpoint, I really did have to decide, like, if I'm going to be in a public space anymore, one part of me wanted to just kind of go, it doesn't really matter. You know, it doesn't really matter whether I'm out or I'm not out. Like I wasn't in the closet. I was living my life, but mm-hmm. Did it warrant putting out an AP release, you know, and doing interviews with, you know, international press? I really didn't want to do that, mostly because it just seemed gross and weird, you know, to like tell a story about what was essentially for me, like about the plumbing of my partner. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, it just, I didn't want to drag my family through it and all that kind of other stuff. But at the same time, I was really uncomfortable with this idea of shame that I think people expected, because I've grown up in a time where people get outed against their will, you know, where Harvey Milk was at a time where it's like, if you're gay, you have to come out, you know, this idea that, you know, our silence is damaging to our own experience when we're not allowing other people to know who we are and see us for who we are. I just felt really uncomfortable with this idea that there would be any truth or any potential for anyone to say that I didn't want people to know. So I was like, that's it. People are going to have to know. So I decided to do that interview. And I think, you know, I just didn't want any queer person to think for half any second that they didn't have a right to be who they were and to be able to talk about that. And I was going to be damned if that was going to happen on my watch. Like if I was going to be an example of somebody who was like, maybe she is or maybe she isn't, like, let's just like stop the rumor mill and open up every, you know, shine every light in every place so you guys can all know that and then do whatever you're going to do. So the good news about that was that I really had no idea about what an amazing choice that was going to be, like just personally to be able to say, to be able to just go, oh yeah, I think it does have weight in being able to go, hey, this is where I'm at, you guys. Do with it what you want. But, you know, it's not like I think any heterosexual person who walks down the street putting out a press release about them being heterosexual mm-hmm. and the strange requirement that sometimes on the LGBTQ plus queer community, you know, for us to be able to go, well, you can't assume that I'm straight. So to be able to say that and when it's necessary to be able to go, oh yeah, that's just a known fact. It's one less thing that I have to do mm-hmm. any given day. But the other side of it is just going, now I'm not afraid of anything. Like, it's mm-hmm. kind of weird. Like, there's no worry because I don't know, all the bad things anyone could ever say have already been said. And I think for anybody who hasn't kind of yet kind of gone through that experience yet, not, I mean, I don't know if it's a Facebook thing or whatever the post is or how anyone does it. I mean, I think we just, at the end of the day, we have relationships that we're living our lives. And I think coming out, the idea that it's always a big bang is always just a little bit not accurate to what our real lived experiences are. We're letting that information meet its relevant ears and mm-hmm. the relevant people in our lives at the time when they're necessary. And sometimes mm-hmm. that people are going to be slow on the uptake and you don't owe it to necessarily skyride it in the sky. But I think, you know, kind of going back to portions of our conversation, you have to trust that inner voice too, that says, you're not telling this story right now because you're not wanting to tell it, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe it's necessary too, and it might be inconvenient or it might cost you something. But I, you know, I think the story for me has been that it, what I've gained in response to that is, like, especially from the big bang version of it, is that, you know, there's just nothing that I'm hiding in that. And to be able to go and live with liberty after that and not be, I don't know, I just forget sometimes when I reach, I was actually in Home Depot the other day and my partner grabbed my hand. We were walking down the aisles and didn't even think about it, right? It was just a moment of intimacy. And it didn't occur to me that I was walking in a hardware store holding the hand of a woman in the South mm-hmm. of, you know, in the United States, in a relatively conservative environment where a state who's actively trying to pass laws that, you know, criminalize men in dresses. You know, it's horrible. And yet at the same time, I looked over and I was like, oh, yeah, that's happening. Huh, whatever. You know, and just being able to know that I was just living comfortably. So, I mean, I realize I'm rambling, but, you know, coming out's been a process that's had its versions of really quiet moments and intimate moments then that were incredibly valuable. And I think to me, those are the most critical of my experience, being able to just have real, true people around me that understood what my journey was and understood that I was introducing them essentially to the things that mattered to me in my life, mm. you know, to the people that I loved and invite and welcomed the joy that I was finding by discovering who I was as my own person, by discovering the people and opening themselves up to the people that I loved. I was really lucky in that regard to be able to have incredibly supportive family on both sides of the fence. But then to be able to have that gift and to be able to do that in a public space and then be able to know that that was something that was not going to just land on me, but on a community of people like my family who, you know, are from small town, rural people who now have a famous daughter who's, you know, some people might talk about behind their backs. You know, yeah. It's nice to be able to kind of go through that process, but I think it's been really wonderful to be able to do that, to kind of highlight just how amazingly wonderful it is, because I think all the things that I was afraid of did happen, you know, but at the same time, I think didn't happen quite as severely as I imagined. Mm-hmm. I've had professional knocks in it. I don't make very much money. It means less money and things, you know, my professional opportunities are somewhat limited sometimes as they are. But you know, the real personal danger of not living a full life, you know, like the person that you have to, that lives between your two ears, the person inside my head, my heart and my spirit, I am so happy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much that I wish sometimes that I hadn't paid for on a professional extent, but I would pay for twice as much to know that I've done all the steps that I can do in taking care of myself, having a loving community around me who really do know me and that I really do trust and that respect me. And I don't know that I could have done that without telling them who I really am in some regard, you know. Mm-hmm. That this is a person that I love. And, you know, that might be, it's the same way with music to a degree. Like, I don't want to trivialize it at all, but like, I really love music. And at the end of the day, I love the job that I have. And it appears sometimes to my good working blue collar family that I don't have a real job, but I really love it. And it's something that keeps drawing me in. It doesn't always make logical sense. And, you know, isn't a 9-to-5 thing, and sometimes makes them think, oh man, you're making weird choices because these aren't typical, you know, to be able to make those atypical choices when a majority of other people make something different. Those are not easy things to do, but the people who see where your passions are, the things that you get energy from, the things that make you a better and more gifted human being in this world, when you say, yes, that is my interest, that is my passion, this is who I am. I'm in, you know, not what I'm into. I think it's so weird to have that context, right? Because I could say, well, I'm into music, but music's a fabric of my life. The same way that, you know, my family is a part of the fabric of my life. And the things that I choose and all my energies that I will go into preserving and working hard for and caring for and nurturing, to be able to name those things and say those things out loud, not only makes me realize, wow, how gifted and blessed I am to be able to have all of these things at arm's reach, but that all of those things are things that give back to me. They're not just leeches. They're part of having a community of people around you that give back to you, that aren't just parasitic. But that's, to me, that's what love is. That's what a community is. That's what a family is, whether they're families of choice, careers of choice. We don't always have to be taken away from to be out and living our gifted selves in the world. But in order to do that, we have to know something of our own self underneath of that to be able to preserve and to be able to know and to be able to gift back into our community. So it's a very long story, not very, you know, I don't know. I just never know, like, about how to set off the fireworks are coming out, but it's been gradual in a process. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important. I think sometimes to, at least for me, to show what a fan I am of not necessarily thinking that coming out is always just this big bang pop. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to tell everybody in all one fell swoop. I think it happens gradually in some places and big in others, and is necessary in some places and doesn't necessarily require a press release or a big media post every single time that it happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really agree with the gradual process, and in some ways the coming out to ourselves is the biggest part. And like, you actually were a big part of that for me. And so some of the people that listen to this podcast regularly will know that I did, I think it was back in episode 20, I did one, me and Jennifer Knapp. So you've already been on.
Oh, one. Now I'm going to go look. I'm going to go have a, I'm going to go sneak around and see what happened.
Yeah. So I was in Australia right after graduation in the year 2000. And I was listening to your song. I think it was Undo Me, but I don't know which one. And I just started crying. I felt sick to my stomach. And I was like, I'm gay. And I'm I'm over here doing missions with Youth for Christ. And like, wow, how can I do this? And how can I, like, I'm going to lose everything. I'm going to lose my whole family. I'm going to lose my ministry. I'm going to lose all the things. And just felt sick. And so it's like, it's been so interesting to watch your life, like maybe a few years ahead of mine, and kind of be like having some kinship in it that I'm not alone. I actually pressed it down for the next probably 15 years after that moment of like this deep, deep realization and fear, and finally came out at 33. And so I was also like a late bloomer, and and yet like so much has changed and so much has opened up in my life since then. Yeah. And so it's been cool.
That's a really long time to be able to live with that. I mean, I really can't imagine what that's like. I mean, I think I didn't really have that experience, but I definitely relate to that gut, you know, that it's just, you know, like in those movies when the sound goes, doom.
Yeah. Totally.
Totally that big subwoofer, huge, yeah, kind of the tunnels just closing in, all of, or yeah, disconnect or whatever. Like those moments where we realize it's so weird as an adult or as a, you know, as a developed human being, even if you're, and I think the older we get, the more the volume seems to kind of be deeper and richer when we have those moments where we realize something that absolutely paradigm shifts our own understanding of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Right? It doesn't matter kind of what that might be, but it seems so weird to the, I've had a few of those experiences in my life, and not just with my sexual orientation, but like I had it with depressed, like understanding, oh wow, like I have a attention deficit, like, and to realize like that's something that I didn't know about myself. Mm-hmm. And to discover something about yourself, particularly when you're kind of into the adult stages of yourself, and go, how could I have not known this? Mm-hmm. And when you somewhat open the door going, now that I do know that, it just changes the color of the world so much. And immediately, like, now what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And then depending on how terrifying that shift is or that new vision is, it sometimes takes us a while to adjust to that. And I think for anyone who's had a long-term, how long is this going to take for you to figure out how to live in the new world with this new vision is different for everybody. Some people mm-hmm. do that really quickly. And then it's really easy to judge that if it takes us longer. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in my 50s and I'm still having a couple of those moments every once in a while. It's like, I'm not in my 50s yet. I'm scratching on it. I'm just scratching. The door is open. It's calling out to me. Oh, you want to be 50. But, you know, there's so much that we talk about in public because of the weight of being in the closet and the shame of being in the closet, that has been forced and, you know, doors locked and opportunities that I don't want to like lighten it. It truly does exist. There's a real threat sometimes, and depending on where you live and what you do for a living, whether or not, you know, how threatening that can be, it may be really necessary to not necessary to disclose everything about your life to everybody, wherever you go. Imagine mm-hmm. that. I know mm-hmm. social media and our current context will tell you otherwise, but it's not true. Things are private to you. And there's an important reason why those, you know, intimate details about your life shouldn't necessarily be spread out on the internet or with everybody else. Not everybody's going to treat you well with care, with safety, by having access to your bank account, you know, like mm-hmm. some people will take everything away from you just because they can. But that being said, those moments when we discover something about ourselves that we didn't know can be really terrifying. You know, for me, one of those moments, like, how could I not know? Like, it was embarrassing sometimes mm-hmm. for me to be able to go, yeah, I'm in my late 20s and I think I like girls. Like, how? And some people saying to me, oh, well, you were clearly gay your whole life. And I'm like, well, yeah, it makes sense to me now that I see it. You know, mm-hmm. like it might have been something that I could have seen earlier. And it was embarrassing and difficult because now I presented myself in a way and do it. What does this mean? Because I didn't have any role models. There wasn't anybody that I was looking to model my life mm-hmm. on. So then I had to kind of learn, like, it's weird. Like when you're 9 years old, you're just absorbing the world that's around you, right? You don't tend to think as coherently, like, now what am I going to do? Like, you just do it and you just live. But the learning when we're older gets a little bit more complicated and a little bit more self-conscious and all those other things. But that pressure, I think sometimes that the overlapping of the old school, of that old closet mm. and fear of that closet being pressed on with this new version of a lot less assumption that you have to stay in the closet. Like there are people going like, you know, I'm running into young people, like adolescents going, I'm not really sure where I'm at. Like, I'm not sure what my sexual orientation is going to be. I'm not sure, you know, I'm somewhere in the middle. And they might, you know, odds are pretty good. A fair bit of those are going to be like heteronormative kid, like heterosexual kids, but maybe not, you know, breaking up what ideals of a woman's going to be or what a man's going to be. All of these roles are now starting to change and get quote unquote queered a lot because there's just no heteronormative standard that's being set out there. So I think there's a lot less pressure for us to do that now. And I think that's kind of easing up the sense of going, you know, you're not obligated to necessarily send out a press release, but you'll know. And to be able to understand and take the risks at the right time and trust your own voice and guard your own self and guard your own safety. But, you know, spend some time going, am I guarding? Because here's the thing, like one of the things that I remembered when I was contemplating whether or not I was going to go back and play music or not. So I'd spent all this time not playing music. And the anecdote for me was that I realized that I wasn't picking up my guitars and I wasn't playing. I'll follow this thread of logic here for a second. I was afraid to pick up my guitars because I was afraid if I picked up my guitars, I would write music. And if I wrote music, people would probably, those songs are crazy. They're like, they want to be heard. It's kind of a weird thing. Like if I do the thing that I do, then people will find out and they'll go, well, how come you aren't playing that? And I didn't want to do any of that because I didn't want to even have to contemplate going out into a world where people would ask me that question. Mm-hmm. Are you gay? Like that was one of the things. I was like, I wasn't doing one of the things I was made to do mm-hmm. because I was afraid of answering a question.
Was that part of your shutting down your first career too?
No, strangely enough, the shutting down of my first career was because I'd shut myself down. Like in order to live inside of that extremely conservative evangelical community, I wasn't able to talk about the theological things that I was learning about. I had theological disagreements for a long time about the way that the church was talking about sex and sin and gay people and just a myriad of things. I didn't want to be the poster child for that anymore. At the time, it was a big, like one of the things for me was that people were asking me to step into what was essentially the purity movement and be a role model for other women, which is basically for women inside that environment, it's pretty targeted for trying to get women to not have sex. Like guys don't really have that much, but I was essentially starting to understand that people were seeing me as this role model of whatever a Christian woman was supposed to look like. And I'm like, I'm not fucking that. Like, I don't want to be that. Like, so like the shutting down was more of a resistance. Like I couldn't be, and I didn't want to be in that environment. And I realized how much I had shut myself down. I had been celibate for 10 years. I didn't have any meaningful relationships at all because I was too afraid to be close to anybody because I didn't want anybody to know what I really thought, you know, what I was really thinking about theology, what I was really feeling inside of my body, what I really was like when I was at home at the rest of the day, you know, like I just was shutting myself off from the world and I didn't want to live in that environment anymore. So I didn't know who I was and I didn't know who my own voice was. I'm like, I can't figure out. I was too afraid of my own voice, I thought, and suspicious of my own voice that I knew that that wasn't a safe place for me to do it. So I just like, you have to walk away because I am not going to survive this if I don't, you know, I'll never find my voice again. And if that means that I lose music, then I lose music because I'm not going to lose my life to it. And so it's kind of weird. Like, I think a lot of people, it's really easy to say, oh, you quit that first career because you found out you were gay. I'm like, no, I didn't even know if I was gay yet because I couldn't even, right. I couldn't even look at my own self.
Yeah.
Like I genuinely couldn't even go, am I really interested in the woman that I really think I'm interested in? Because I couldn't do it in that environment. I just couldn't. And I didn't know that, you know, I even wanted to be a Christian anymore. And I couldn't even answer that question or do that work inside of that space. And those were those questions, you know, all the questions that I had were somewhat related to each other sometimes and completely divorced. They were independent things. But at the end of the day, like I left that because I just couldn't, it wasn't an environment conducive to me discovering and being and living the whole life that I knew somehow that I had put on hold in order to do that career. Mm-hmm. And in order to come back, I realized that I had an opportunity to do something I was really gifted at, that I really genuinely loved. And then all of the things that I knew would be obstacles or potentially that I'd have to answer for were things that I was afraid of, not afraid of answering for, but afraid of being confronted with. And there's a difference. Like, mm-hmm. like there's a difference between being able to say, well, that was, I think, for me in that process, this is the point, is that I realized that I wasn't doing things that I was made to do that would make my life wonderful, things that I genuinely wanted to do and participate, create and do music again, that I wasn't doing it because I was afraid, because I couldn't see what was going to happen. I was saying no to something that I wanted to do because I was afraid of all the things that I couldn't control. Mm-hmm. I was afraid of all the things that I thought might happen. And even so, like one day, I think I'm not sure, it might have been my partner, or it might have been the voice in my head, but it's essentially the, well, what happens if all of those things, the worst case scenario happens? What happens if you start playing music again and all the things that you're afraid of, if they happen, do you still want to do music? And I kind of went, yeah, I think I still do, you know? And I think, you know, in terms of context of coming out, if all the things that you're afraid of do and can happen, it doesn't make you less gay, you know? It's kind of weird. Like, it's like all the things that we'll ever have to come out to or realize or take on board is it can never really get you to sidestep the things that are going to be difficult about that process. The question is, when are you going to do the work to prepare yourself to get ready for the difficult things that are ahead of you? And that, yeah, right? That was the thing that, for me, that was my moment. Where I was like, I am not doing, I like had to be honest with the voice in my head going, you're not doing this work because you're being a chicken. And you really want to do it. And you're questioning whether or not you want to do the hard work to prepare yourself to be able to go through and do it. You know, this is what is going, this is a wall that I'm going to have to break through. And if I want to live at peace with my own self, I'm like, that's the wall. I'm looking right at it. So that's what you just kind of have to do. And I'm not saying do it foolishly or anything like that. I mean, I was slow. I came back to Nashville. I made some recordings. I was like, yeah, this is actually, you know, I needed that evidence for myself. Like, I put the music together. I'm like, oh, this is really actually good music. I really wanted to go out and play. I started doing a couple shows and I'm like, I really do want to do these shows. And then finally, yeah, pull that ripcord. Let's go. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's the part of that that's really beautiful is like, there's no way around any difficult situation in our lives. It's just the question is like, how much responsibility do you have? And being able to look at what your capacity is and go at the pace that's good for you and meaningful to you, but honest to you. Because otherwise we're all just living in the closet. We're all just being held back from the things that make us whole. A truly, you know, the gifts that any of us have in our own lives are not just gifts because they're fun for us to do and they're enjoyable. You know, I'm a musician. I love it. I'm good at it. I really enjoy playing, but it's not just good for me. It's good for my community too, when I'm comfortable in myself enough to be able to give it away. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of the work that any of us do on ourselves, I think, right? To be able to know that we're not such a scarce, you know, the product of who we are is not in such scarcity that we're not willing to share it with others. And for me, at the end of the day, that's what coming out is really a story. And I think one of the beautiful things our queer community teaches the rest of the world is that it's like something is lost outside of us to the people that we love, to our communities, when we are not comfortable in sharing who we are to our community in some way that's honest and open and received as well by the community of us and valued by the community around us. It has to be a mutual kind of thing. And it's kind of weird because at the end of the day, our community is not going to know us if we're not out in it. And, you know, those are hard yards to build relationships, and whether they're breaking heteronormative standards or they're building relationships with new and strange people for no other reason than socially. But it's a thing. Like, you have to be able to invest in it at home and believe in who you are and have enough confidence to be able to do that.
Yeah. Super vulnerable, but so important to be seen and known. Another premise of the podcast is that, like you were saying, like, anytime we're growing, there's a new layer of us that we're letting go of, and this like truer center of who we are is being exposed in the world. And so I would say, like, anyone who's growing is going through another coming out stage. And so you've told us about, you know, your queer coming out, your ADHD coming out. Is there something that you feel is brewing now that is kind of your next coming out chapter that you feel you could share with us?
Yeah, aging. No, seriously. It's I've been bitching about my age since I was about 37. And I still have been doing about it. I've been dealing with it. I mean, it's, you know, every once in a while, I'm really surprised at how, when I get up in the mirror morning and I look in the mirror, how old the woman is in front of me. Like, she's not the 20-year-old person I think is in my mind when I don't see a picture of myself. But the reason why I say that is like, it's interesting at this stage of my life where like music as a context and what I do for a living, I love writing, I love playing, I love performing, but I've also done a lot of it and I'm not done of doing it, but how do I explain how boring it can be? Like, been there, done that. And
monotonous.
Yeah. And the parts of us, I think, that are genuinely as human beings intrigued by learning new things, by having, you know, fresh new opportunities, you know, lovers can be like that. Mm-hmm. You know, if we do the same thing over and over and over again, we can fail to kind of appreciate how special that is. Right. So that's all to say is that I've been trying to make sense of what that means when I've been doing this for a long time and when I don't want to quit what I'm doing, trying to settle in. And it's been partly in embracing that I actually am getting older. Like, and with that I actually can say I'm really good at what I do. You know, that's been really hard to be able to go, I'm really good at what I do. Mm-hmm. And I love what I have and I love the knowledge that I have about what I do. And the shift of going, oh my gosh, I am now, I think, about ready to come out as the wise grandmother on the porch in the rocking chair.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a weird thing. I'm still working on the language of it, but it's been embracing like where I am at this stage of my life with the experiences that I've had of going, oh my gosh, I am now leaning into the mentorship years. And why that's important to embrace. And it's hard because it's hard to embrace it because I don't like the idea of the fact that my body is aging out. But on the other side of it, I'm really in accepting that, going, oh my gosh, I've been able to kind of reappreciate all the things that I've been able to do. Like all the experiences that I've had in the 30 plus years that I've been doing what I've been doing, the 30 years of experience that I have as a faith-based leader, I'm actually knowledgeable in that space. Mm-hmm. And it's been really hard for me to say that out loud. Oh, I do take responsibility and I am leading. Like, but to be able to take that on, the distinction of not just doing that accidentally, but then changing that and what I know, unfortunately, with experience is that by taking responsibility and saying, yes, I will, and fill in the blank and not just accidentally do something, but say, no, I will be responsible for this. I take it on. I want to learn more about what it means to be available for the wisdom that I have and also spend time learning about how do I organize that wisdom in such a way that it's transmissible and meaningful to others. Mm-hmm. And what experience do I have to get over my own bullshit and my own insecurities about that wisdom? Mm-hmm. And to be willing to share it, because I'm actually pretty shy at the end of the day. I don't think that I want to actually say, oh, I don't have that much wisdom, or I don't have that much mm-hmm. experience, or I'm not as good at that because of a lot of other insecurities, and saying, no, we actually lack mentorship. Like every time that I think about my, you know, whether I'm talking about my faith-based experience or my musical experience, my experience as a woman inside of a very male-dominated industry, like a lot of other things where I just wish that somebody else was there to just not just be visible, but be available.
Mm-hmm.
To talk it through and to add to the wisdom and the mentorship, not just telling me how to do something, because I think you can look up YouTube. Like, I just did all the plumbing repairs in my house. I can look up YouTube and figure out how to repair stuff in my car, to my house. I can do surgery on somebody, right? Right. But it doesn't mean I know anything. Mm-hmm. I can watch and repeat the steps of other people before me, but for people to actually teach me something. And I think that's the part that has been a coming out thing for me, is going, I'm accepting that part first in myself and then making myself, I think the next steps are making myself available to other people to be able to do that, to be the person that I see in myself.
What's the most attractive way to do that for you? Like, what would be the most fun way to do it?
I really love talking, as if you couldn't tell. I mean, podcasts have been, you know, believe it or not, with COVID, it was a really great time because everybody was doing all this remote stuff. And I did a hell of a lot of podcasts during that time. And I just started kind of practicing, I think, in terms of like religious leadership or conversations in around faith spaces. I spent a lot of time on podcasts and deconstruction podcasts, being able to say for the first time some of the things I only thought in private for the last 30 years. And to be able to kind of woodshed those out. So I think it's been a combination of like what makes it attractive is one, you know, opening the door to the possibility and saying, oh, I'm really good at it. Like when I look at the dialogues that I've had and how meaningful that they've been, look for the evidences of like, is it not just something I'm doing because it's enjoyable to me, but is it actually useful to others? Which is a question that I ask older now than I did when I was younger. But that's also a question that I'm, that point alone is like one I'm super excited about. Like any artist or any influencer that I see today, and we're now in an influencing society, I'm like, yeah, great. It's not just beneficial to you, but what is that talent that you have or that gift or that, how is that beneficial to others? Like that's a real thing that I want out living in the world for any of us to do, no matter what we do, whether you're a truck driver or a plumber or an artist, or, you know, it's not just being a drain on everything else around us, but, being good at something so we can add to a vibrant and beautiful world. And to be able to have the opportunity to practice that has been become more, more attractive. Podcasts have been really good. And then seeing that I've been able to do that in that space, then how do I organize that in some sense for my daily work? Like, how do I actually make that my work? And what, you know, what shape does that take? So that's, I'm still answering that question. I do have a publishing contract that I've had, you know, a book that my publisher's been waiting on for a couple of years and that took me a long time to actually look at because I was like, oh, I didn't even value my own voice in that. It's kind of a weird thing. And now I'm having to go, oh, I want to write this book. And now I have no idea what I'm doing. So I've got another book that's in the works. I'm trying to organize some podcasts to be able to have these kinds of dialogues because I think, you know, their podcasts are so great right now because I think a lot of us do want to hear that. We do want to hear the conversations and be not just read it, but to be able to hear the tangible voices and be able to feel like we're included in the conversation of the things that allow us to talk through some of these things. Cause not all of us learn by reading. We learn by participating in dialogue. So.
Totally. Well, thank you so much for taking time today and sharing your wisdom with us. And I also applaud that you're acknowledging that you have wisdom, because I think that's another thing that kind of got drained out of the women in the patriarchy is like, oh, you're so stuck up if you say that. But it's like, no, like, I'm fucking awesome at this and I'm going to share it.
I'm so uncomfortable when you say that. Yeah. But I mean, it is a thing. We do have a wisdom. And what is the part of us that looks at the gifts that we have in that sense, or the knowledge that we have to be able to share that, is a really hard thing, at least for me. And I think probably not, you know, some of us will have to say, it's like, yeah, I do own this. I like not own it as in a possessiveness, but it's inhabited. It's as, it's in you and it's not going away. And it is the part of you when it's polished and shined and deliberate and well-fed and well-rested and well-cared for is an incredibly, immensely powerful thing to do something that you have a decision to make. What will I do with this incredible power? What? Because we all do have that. And to figure out what that gift is only makes our lives richer individually, but makes our world a better place. And however we come to that, how we learn how to come out and go, yeah, I really am this, fill in the blank. And this is what I want to be better at and care for and nurture and be responsible for. And that isn't just an LGBTQ question. That is a life thing that I am just shocked to have learned.
I think it's a great question for everybody listening. It's like, what can you notice that you're really good at in the world and rock that and
do it?
We're all enriched when that happens.
Indeed we are. So give it to us. Bring it on.
And you, my friend, have enriched my life so much over the years. So I'm so happy that we've connected and I know you're going to keep rocking it.
Well, thank you so much for having this conversation, Nancy. I really enjoyed my afternoon.
See you later.
Thanks for listening to the Coming Out Chronicles. If you enjoyed it and you think it would be helpful for someone else, please share it with them. If you'd like to connect with me, reach out on social. I'd love to support you in the next chapter of your coming out story. I can help you know yourself, free yourself, and be yourself. Until next time, this is Nancy Shadlock from Centered Life Coaching.